This is What's Your Story, a program that people seem to like. We've had over 1,000 downloads so far in just over 10 weeks, so there's 100 a week at least. It's probably not the same 100. Listening to our podcasts, and we don't discriminate. We interview pretty much anybody who'll agree to come along and tell us their story, because a lot of people who live in Apollo Bay didn't get born here. A few did, but a lot come from somewhere else, and they come by circuitous routes. And, of course, everyone has a story, and those stories enrich all of our lives. So that's why we do this thing called What's Your Story on 3ABR. And here in the studio with me is a young woman who needs no introduction to locals, but her name is Libby Riches. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Bob.
How old are you?
41.
You're not.
I am.
It's not possible.
I'm not that young.
Good.
Sorry.
Grief.
If you wanted a young person, you need to look further afield.
So what year does that mean you were born?
1974.
74?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I won't reminisce about what I was doing in 74. But so where did you get born?
I got born in Melbourne in the Women's Hospital.
Yep.
The Women's Hospital, one of the hospitals in Melbourne, anyway, yes. And grew up in the leafy green suburb of Surry Hills.
Surry Hills?
Yes, until the age of about 12.
Okay.
Yes.
Surry Hills, home to the Minogue sisters.
Indeed, yes. In fact, in the second house we lived in Surry Hills, we were just around the corner from the Minogue sisters, a fact that failed to impress me during my angst-ridden teen years in Surry Hills.
We rented their house once a long time ago.
There you go.
Yeah.
Small world.
It is a small world. Mm. So, but it's a very pretty suburb.
It is. It's lovely. Yeah.
So, and you weren't the only little Riches?
No, I have an older brother called Tim.
Okay.
Yes.
And how do we get on with Tim? How much
older? Oh, well, he's 4 years older. Now we get on extremely well. I think he certainly hated me as a child, and I pathetically adored him as four-year-old younger sisters tend to do. He was not pretty for a very long time. Terrible fighting, rampant fighting.
All
yes.
Right. So how did the parental units deal with this?
I've got no idea. My parental units are pretty chilled out kind of people. I'm sure we drove them completely nuts. The benefit was that we lived in a very big house, and it wasn't just my parents, it was my grandparents as well.
Oh, great.
So there were the three generations of us in the house, which meant that we could disperse quite effectively across a fairly large territory, which I think made it much easier for everybody.
Okay. Mm. Do you have a first memory? Is there something that you...
Yes. My first memory is looking out of my cot. So this must be one of those memories that you drag up from your deep, deep subconscious. This was when my cot was still in my brother's room. And his room was opposite the house of a mad scientist. I mean, like literally a mad scientist. I think he worked for CSIRO, and he had about one functional room in his house.
Yeah.
And the rest was shambles, like a complete shambles. And my first memory is seeing him ironing on top of his piano. The silhouette of him ironing on top of his piano from my cot.
Now, normally I would accuse you of making that up.
Maybe I am.
I
don't
know. You're an honest woman.
Yeah, I'm an honest woman, sure. Let's go with that.
That's amazing.
Mm.
So you have a clear memory of looking out the window and seeing this with grey hair and eccentric disposition?
Very eccentric disposition.
Yeah.
My first act of doing something naughty as a child that I remember was stealing mail from his mailbox.
Okay.
And about 5 years later, he got himself into terrible trouble with the tax office. And for a couple of misguided years, I was convinced that that was my fault for stealing the mail from his letterbox. But yeah, he was a very eccentric man. It was like a gothic mansion with a mad scientist living in it.
Wow, fantastic.
Brilliant.
And so this was a source of amusement and fear for you coming and going to school?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Completely. Yeah. Brilliant.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you remember being in the cot. That's amazing. So then you're off to school, to early school days. This is yep. at, you go to Camberwell.
Canterbury Primary
Canterbury
School.
Canterbury Primary, yes. Yeah, yeah. You go to Canterbury Primary,
yep.
yes.
Indeed. Yep.
And you weren't kidding about middle-class privilege.
So. Oh, no, no, no. I'm telling you, I have the most conventional tale ever told, yes.
So, but in Canterbury middle class, there were no people of other nationalities or...
No, actually, I don't think that there were. There was a member of the de Kretser clan, the mm. former Governor General's yep. family. So they're Sri Lankan, they have Sri Lankan mm. yep. heritage. But that's all I can recall.
Okay.
Mm.
So, but what about the school? What about going to school? Did you so you walked to school?
I walked to school. Yep. Yeah, I walked to school every day. I think, apart from a terrible year in grade one, which you should probably ask my mother about when you interview her.
Okay.
When I had terrible childhood meltdowns and they had to drag me to school in the car. But other than that,
so
I walked to school.
Do you remember the meltdowns?
Oh, completely. Yes.
You do?
Yeah, yeah.
Still to this day?
Yes. Oh, yes. It was terrible. Yeah.
So how did you, what was going on?
I don't know. I just did not want to go to school. I didn't want to be away from home. I was frightened of my teacher. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't want to go. So, I was a notoriously strong-willed child, so,
yes.
which caused my mother in particular no end of grief.
Yeah, and you grew up into such a wishy-washy.
Oh, yes, that's right, exactly. Oh, they're just total pushovers, all of them. Well, my mother would probably say that she is, but yeah. We all know better than that. So,
so your folks literally dragged you to school? Just kept
yeah,
on, kept
pretty
on
much.
Keeping on.
Kept
yeah.
on keeping on, yeah, just went with it. And it was just one of those phases, you know, didn't really mean anything, and we all moved on, mostly. Yeah, walking to school from there on in. And I loved it.
So no psychic damage, you don't think?
I don't think so.
No.
Not to me, anyway. You'd have to ask my parents about that. Yeah.
So then year two, this evaporated because the teacher
yep.
changed?
And pretty much,
Everything was hunky-dory?
Everything was fine, yeah. Uneventful.
Okay.
Uneventful.
And so, but then you were playing sport and things. You're excelling in
math. So the other part of my story is that my elder brother is extremely, or was, because he's not at school any longer, extremely academically gifted.
Okay.
And he left, when he left primary school, he trialled the new gifted children's program at university high school, which he, I think he started year 12 when he was 15 and was done and dusted by the time he was 16 and sort of went on from there. Mm. So in... sort of comparison to that, I was relatively relentlessly mediocre, basically, in many things. I have no talent for mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to get a tutor for maths in grade 5, and it basically went downhill from there for many, many, many terrible years.
Mm-hmm. That's maths in particular.
And things that required rote learning of any variety.
Okay.
But I was good at English and history and art and all of those things. So I did lots of things like library monitoring and debating and art stuff. Never been any good at any sport ever and never really been interested in any sport ever. All humanities kind of stuff. That was me. Yeah.
So and you did quite well at those.
I did well at those.
Yeah,
yes.
You did well at those.
Yes.
So this wasn't a this was your natural disposition, not a response to the gifted brother thinking, if he's bright, I'm not going to be.
No, that's right. It was that's just naturally where I sat.
Okay.
But I'm
yep.
you know never a solid student, but perhaps never a stellar one.
So you turned up and you cared and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I turned up and I cared. Yeah, I worked hard. My mum always says I used to work hard. I have no particular memory of that. I remember sitting in my room with my textbooks, listening to the radio and drawing a lot, maybe that's what Mum mistook as studying. But I showed up and I cared.
Okay.
I liked school. I liked study all the way through.
So, and for high school, where did you go?
So, for high school, I went to Campbell Anglican Girls Grammar School. See, it just gets better, doesn't it?
Wow.
It just gets better.
The atmosphere gets more refined.
That's right. Well, although I should say that when we were 12, we sold the house in Surry Hills.
Mm.
And the main reason for selling that house was to build the house in Apollo Bay on the block that we'd been coming down to for many years. And we rented a place in Northcote. So I moved from Surry Hills to Northcote at the age of 12.
Shock. Yeah.
It was a culture shock. It was completely great, and I loved it. I mean, Surry Hills was great for a kid, and Northcote was great for a teenager, so it was perfect.
So, and in the meantime, were you any kind of girl guide or any other kind
Oh, no, I was terrible. You know, I was the classic middle class punk with the mohawks and the Robert Smith hair and the fishnet stockings and the Doc Martens and the whole thing, really.
So so you were dressing really aggressively,
yes,
assertively.
Yes, indeed. Yes, that would be one way of putting it. Yes.
And were you behaving to match, or was it just?
I was very well behaved.
A well behaved mohawk
until I left school.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
So during school, you turned up and sat in class with your orange mohawk and.
Well, of course, they wouldn't. That was for holidays.
Okay. So, right.
Yes.
So they
I had to kind of, you know, part
Anglican,
it nicely. It was the Anglican school.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, it was all uniform and all that kind of stuff. Look, I was a complete girly swot at school. I loved it. I loved studying. I loved writing. I loved thinking. I loved being in class.
Yeah.
I liked studying.
So,
yeah.
And socially at this time, you're sort of 12 or 15. What are you doing? Yeah.
Not much, just hanging out with friends.
So,
we'd
And their mates from school?
Yeah, mates from school. Yeah, we'd go and I had one friend in particular who I just spent all my time with, and we would go to Melbourne and cruise the record shops.
Okay.
You know, flick through vinyl and sit in the city. That's what we did.
And do you still have some of those school friends now? Do you still? Are you in
I do.
With
yeah, I do. My my closest friend from school, I got in touch with her on Facebook a few years back, and we've been catching up fairly frequently since then. Yeah, she'd be the main one. We're the most similar still in hindsight, I'd say, in terms of values and interests and things like that. Yeah.
So it sounds like school, you had a good time at school.
Yeah, I had a good time at school,
yeah.
I'm telling you, most boring tale ever told.
Well, no, it's not boring. It's interesting. And you were going to the odd rock concert, the odd, you know.
Yeah, I had some absolutely fabulous fake ID, which I think I actually hand-coloured in with Derwent pencils and ran through the laminator. But at the Old Greek Theatre, they did not care.
Yeah,
they just did not care. And the deal was, particularly with my best friend's dad, was that he would drive us there and he'd come out at any time of night and pick us up from the gig. He knew we were getting in illegally, provided we weren't drinking, that was fine.
Yeah.
So that was the deal we struck, and that worked just perfectly.
Okay. And so you cruised through to year 12?
Cruised through to year 12,
Behaving yourself, apparently.
Behaving myself, yeah.
And then after year 12, some things changed.
Well, about 2 weeks after I finished year 12, I met Pete, who I'm now married to.
Good grief.
Okay. So,
All right.
Yes.
Well, hold that thought. We might just play some music and come back for the rampant teenage Libby Richards.
No.
This is 3ABR, and this is Dave Alvin.
I don't know what happened, Bob, and I really don't want to talk about it in too much detail on public radio because I do have four generations of my family living in this town.
Well, they all know the story.
No,
the younger ones don't, maybe.
All four generations know the story. The paternal and maternal units probably have the best knowledge. But, you know, it was, what did they call it back then? It was the summer of love of the late 90s.
Yep.
The rave scene was going pretty strong. I met Pete at a party, and the next 5 years are pretty much something of a blur.
Something in the blood. So this is what I would call doof doof music.
Yes, indeed.
This
yes.
Is going doof, doof,
yeah.
And
that's
the lights
right.
Are flashing.
That's right. Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Indeed.
And people are sweating and gyrating.
That's right.
Long into the night and
yes, that's
and
then, right.
And way into the morning.
That's
and then,
right.
And then
yes.
Rolling along and picking up falafels or
pretty much.
Yeah,
that's it.
That.
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're wearing what?
Oh, you know, big baggy pants and ridiculous hats and sneakers and, you know, odd T-shirts.
And Pete's in this club as well? Yeah?
Oh, yeah, indeed. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, probably I wouldn't have gone there quite so much if it wasn't for Pete.
So what attracted you to him? Did he bust a good move or something? Or what?
No, we're both terrible dancers. We just really got along really well right from the outset, and that was pretty much it. We were interested in the same music, the same books, the same films, the same ideas, the same art, Our temperaments matched really well. We just had fun together. We just really had fun together.
So it was a party that you met at, not a
met
rave?
We met at a party, a friend's party.
Because I defy anyone to establish any kind of relationship at a rave.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are some relationships you can establish at a rave, but probably not lasting ones.
What was the thinking that was clearly part of the glue of the relationship? Was it this alternative culture stuff, or was it
literature? I think it's just how well we got along. We just enjoyed being together.
Okay.
And that was it. We just enjoy each other's company, just like friends with extras.
Yeah.
Enjoy each other's company.
Mm.
Had more fun with each other than other people.
Do you remember what you were reading or discussing at the time?
I was reading William Gibson's sci-fi trilogy, Neuromancer.
Okay.
And I was watching Japanese manga and Akira Kurosawa movies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Gee, some things don't change. I reckon my daughter Matilda's probably just doing pretty much similar stuff.
Yeah. And I'm still watching Akira Kurosawa movies.
Yeah,
the manga's dropped off a little.
The
younger ones are taking that one on. But, yeah, yes.
Okay. And so, and where did Pete come from? Does he have a similar?
You need a probably five-part series to do Pete. And
okay.
I could not even touch that iceberg. And I suggest that you ask if he's interested and if he would be willing to tell that tale on radio, because it is the tale.
Okay.
The tale.
And so was this part of the attraction? His wild background? Unusual. Different to you. Let's not make any suppositions.
Yeah, maybe. He was a lot older than I was, so he's 9. He was 20.
Is.
Yeah, he still is. It's funny that. He was 26 when I met him and I was 17.
Ah, okay.
So he was, he was independent.
Mm.
He was a projectionist at the time, which was frightfully romantic, in a kind of both literally romantic but in kind of classic steam engine sense of the word romance.
Yeah.
Romance. He had a bio box in an old Hoyts complex in the city with just all these massive rows of projectors.
So did he take you up there and romance you?
Absolutely. We'd go in at midnight and do the test reels of the films.
Oh,
and
fabulous.
It was great. And that was really appealing. And, in hindsight, I realised that, unfortunately, it's probably that classic trap of girls falling for people who were just like their fathers, because I thought it was pretty cool that he could actually do stuff, like mechanical, physical,
like
actually do
yeah.
work and make these complex machines work and create a show. And, I was impressed by that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that was it for you?
Unexpectedly.
But he wasn't your first fella, was he?
He was my first serious fella, yeah.
Okay.
It was
a couple of crash test dummies.
Barely worthy of the name,
Okay.
It wasn't an intended long-term relationship. It just kind of worked out that way.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it just started and kept going.
So you're 17 now?
Yes.
16, 17?
Yep.
You've done reasonably well at year 12 and you're going to get some tertiary education?
Yep.
So what happened? What did you do?
So I started, I did an arts degree at Melbourne Uni for a year and a half.
Yep.
And in doing that, I realised that what I wanted to do was archaeology and particularly prehistoric and Australian archaeology. So I took myself out of Melbourne University with much pleasure, because Melbourne University was full of the people I'd been at school with anyway.
And by now you were getting
a little bit over it.
A bit tedious.
Yeah. I mean, they were frightfully lovely people, but it was just more of the same.
Mm.
And I was increasingly not seeing myself going down a path into a conventional private school, post-private school life. So I dropped out of Melbourne and I went to La Trobe and did a degree in Australian archaeology, which turned into an honours degree, which turned into a master's, which turned into a doctorate.
Okay.
And I was out of there, I was 28, I think. So I didn't leave school until I was 28.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're not, did you just get to scratch around at rocks for a living?
No, I've never been a rock scratcher. All my work was in native title and policy and and heritage management, that kind of stuff.
All right.
I was more interested in the bigger problems of making making heritage work for people than in scratching the rocks.
So how did that interest develop? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I've always liked problem solving.
Mm.
And at the time, Australian archaeology was the biggest problem in archaeology. Mm. It had a lot of very difficult and intriguing insights into human history globally, and that's what attracted me to it first. And then I think as I studied more about it and I learnt more about the cultural context, I became very interested in the problem of Aboriginal people within the broader community and how the science of archaeology was impacting on those cultures and how those two things were working together. So a very intellectual kind of interest. But my my mother has always accused me of having an overdeveloped sense of social justice, which I definitely inherited from you, Mum. And so that was probably quite an appropriate meeting of things there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did you spend a lot of time in country? Did you get away, or was it all kind of vicarious and through the?
Well, for my there was quite a bit of field work involved for assessment throughout uni. My doctorate was, there was a bit of time up in Wadi Wadi country on the Murray. But other than that, I went to Canada, to the Arctic Institute of North America, which is in Calgary, so not nearly as exciting as it sounds in terms of location. And then after I got my doctorate, I've spent quite a lot of time in Gunditjmara country out west Victoria, and some of my consulting jobs have taken me probably to most of the Victorian Aboriginal communities.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when did you meet your first Aboriginal?
I met the first Aboriginal person I met was Gary Foley at a gig at the Palace in St Kilda.
Right. Yeah, well, that's
yep.
I bought mutton bird oil from Gary Foley.
Yeah, right. See, that just sounds perfect.
out in the country. I mean, away from anywhere.
Away from anywhere. Well, I mean, in Victoria, Victorian Aboriginal communities are never that far away from anywhere because nobody here is that far away from anywhere.
I mean, I'm just interested because you grew up without any, you know, barely, a token Indian at school.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so now suddenly you're studying the lives or the history of Indigenous people, both here and in Canada.
Yeah.
So was it just some attraction that it was the other? And how did you feel when you started meeting the people who inhabit those cultures?
Yeah, I suppose it's probably true that there was an attraction to the other. Mm. And I do, even aesthetically, I enjoy those kind of post-colonial nations and those ideas of difference visually and in terms of cultural product and stuff. Mm. So, definitely that. Having said that, the actual encountering of people from other cultures and radically different social environments, like Victorian Aboriginal communities, it never seemed that unusual. It always just seemed like, you're just sort of other people, you're a bit different. But, my upbringing was, my parents, very tolerant, very open-minded people. The fact that anybody would actually be actually different on the basis of their race or ethnicity or, economic circumstances it wasn't actually particularly part of the way I saw the world. So I tended to take people how they come.
So, and these weren't lessons that were taught. These were things that you came to discover through the way your parents lived.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they would, they would call people up or call me up on anything that seemed to be intolerant or judgmental.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff didn't fly, and never has
flown.
There's
a lot of that that goes on in Camberwell.
That's right. That's right.
Right car, right shoes, right.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Whatever.
Yeah. I think in the time when my parents were there, they talk about that time as being quite a kind of lefty, artsy alternative, that kind of tranche of the middle class were out there. So all sort of incredibly tolerant in theory and never having really to have to practice it, you know, in a real world situation. So, and yeah, certainly one of the great challenges of working with Aboriginal communities is the extreme disadvantage that sits in those communities. And that, you know, creates a personal and social history that I have no experience of. You know, that's quite hard to bridge that gap when you just don't have that experience.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so you've got your PhD.
Yep.
And you're finally ready to earn a living of some kind.
Yep.
What happens? What do you do?
I got a job in like a lesbian hippie collective in Brunswick.
Okay.
Who did environmental community consulting. I mean, that's a very glib phrase. I shouldn't say that in case anybody's listening.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Is anybody listening? They did great work. They did really interesting projects, but archaeology departments are not politically correct places. They're big men who drink a lot in beards and make really inappropriate jokes. And I'd spent 10 years in an archaeology department.
Okay.
And I blundered into this place where I was regularly described as refreshing. And we all know what that means. And I did some, I had the great privilege to do some incredibly interesting projects there on what's called social value. So assessing the nature of people's relationship to place.
Okay.
Not as reflected in cultural heritage, like not buildings and street names and stuff, but in story and history and memory and using that information to make management decisions about places. And so the first place I went to was the former Maribyrnong Defence Site, which was incredible. And the second was White Bay Power Station in Sydney, which was just absolutely a mind-blowing sight. And, yeah, then lots of work down with the Gunditjmara people over a number of years, number of projects on the eel traps and that landscape down there. Yeah.
And during this time, then, the relationship is cementing itself, as, you know, you and Peter?
Yeah, so at some point during my PhD, I popped the most unromantic proposal in the history of proposals, and we got married.
Okay. So you'd been living together.
We'd been living together and sneering cynically at the patriarchy for quite some time.
Okay.
After about 10 years, I sort of went, oh, actually, quite like you, you know, and maybe it would actually be quite nice to get married. And I fretted on that for quite some time before sort of sitting up bolt upright in bed in a, you know, breaking sweat at one point. And Pete's going, what's the matter? What's the matter? And I said, would you, you know, what would you ever actually consider marrying me? And he went, yeah. Oh, you asking? Oh, yeah, all right. And that was it. So we got married in the house on the hill on Broughton's Access.
Yep.
I think the wedding was there maybe. My parents had sold the place and I hadn't signed the papers for settlement and stuff, but it was just after they sold
this
that house.
So by this time, your folks are mostly down here?
My grandparents have moved down. My parents have moved down. They're all living in the house on the hill.
So, I mean, I'll talk to your mum a bit about it, but because it's a lot about place. So how did you feel about Apollo Bay and what drew them to Apollo Bay? Do you know?
I don't know what drew them to Apollo Bay. I always loved it.
Okay.
So we came down because Dad was a teacher. He had teachers' hours pretty much every weekend and every school holiday until I was old enough to not have to come down with them.
Yep.
I was down here, and I loved it.
Okay.
I just loved it, yeah.
And clearly that's part of the reason you popped the question to Pete, because he must have liked it too.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
All right. But you didn't get to live here straight away. So, so he survived your PhD.
Yeah, only just, but he did,
And now you're married.
Yes.
And so then...
We buy a house of sorts in Hurstbridge, and I've been in, I don't know, I've had my job for maybe 6, 7, 8 months, and then I find out that I'm pregnant.
Okay.
Which was completely unexpected. Right. And I think that was the day we settled on the house that we bought. So, okay. So yes, so we had a baby.
So attention to detail is not your big thing.
No, apparently not. I thought so, but yes. Well, it must have been okay. I mean, 10 years, So, yeah, just a minor slip.
Okay.
Yeah.
But a very happy one.
A very happy one, yes. Yeah. And indeed very happy, because we'd always said we'll probably one day have kids, but it's one of those things that rationally you're probably actually quite unlikely to make that decision if you're weighing up the pros and cons. Mm. You know, the pros, I don't know, I reckon it's pretty hard for them to outweigh the cons in a rational sense. So we always said if it was going to happen, it would probably happen by accident, and it did.
Sure enough.
So, yeah.
And this changed your life in many ways, but
yeah.
So you've just signed up for the house, so because then you're both working.
Yes, that's right. Pete was self-employed.
Yep.
At the time, I think, or maybe not. He was doing internet stuff anyway, of some variety. Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
So there's enough money around for you for this.
Yeah,
to
kind
this
of, sort of, not really, but you know, what are you going to do? So yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And that goes well, the pregnancy and the labour?
The pregnancy was fine. I had wanted a home birth, which didn't happen. And I had dragged my – we rocked on up at the Royal Women's Hospital in our matching flannelette shirts from Hurstbridge and our plastic buckets full of stuff we'd been prepared to have the home birth with.
Yep.
And launched into the Royal Women's Hospital, and where I proceeded to have a reasonably horrific 26-hour labour, and left the hospital 4 hours later and went home.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It all went fine.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
really.
Just, yeah. 26 is big though.
It was long. Alex was an extraordinarily chilled out person, and he just kept falling asleep and not actually doing any work at all.
You did the pushing.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So yes.
All right. So now you're home with the bub.
Yep.
And doing some full-time mum stuff for a bit.
For about 8 months I was full-time mum.
Mm.
And then I went back to work part-time, I think.
Mm.
And then got pregnant again, I don't know, 18 months to 2 years later.
Yep.
Yep.
So how and when do you migrate here? How do you, what brings that
about? So we used to come down quite a lot to hang out with mum and dad on the hill. We've always got on really well with my folks. And, you know, by the time we had two children, we had no family in Melbourne at all.
Yep.
And we just kept coming down here. Alex clearly benefited from being with grandparents. Mm. And we just got to the point where every Sunday driving home, we didn't want to be doing it.
Okay.
So we thought, well, we'll try and rent a place in Apollo Bay while I was on maternity leave. Mm. A place came up, and so we had Heidi. She was 3 months old, and we packed up with the kids and moved down 8 years ago.
And you didn't have jobs or?
Pete was self-employed at the time, and I was on maternity leave.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And that's 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And so love of place and nearness to family pretty high up on your
absolutely yeah the list. Probably yeah the two highest things on the list, I would say. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you think that's a bit of a consequence of growing up with three generations, you know, from way back? Or
yeah, I think so. Yeah? It seems to me a much more sensible way for people to live. You know, there's more people to do the job of caring for other people, which is a very big job.
Yeah, Kurt Vonnegut famously says that the nuclear family is not a family, it's a survival unit.
Yeah, I reckon that's a really good quote. It feels like that. It does. And if things go off the rails...
Yeah, there's not a lot of capacity.
There's nothing that can pick that up. And if you're that unit and you're 200 kilometres away from your nearest help, that's a hard gig.
Yeah.
And it's hard on the kids. It's hard on the little ones. Mm. So, yeah.
So how did you get the Landcare job?
I think I applied for about three Landcare jobs.
Okay.
I just figured that natural resource management couldn't be that different to cultural resource management in a sort of fundamental sense. Yeah. It's all project management, you know. And I'd written enough research proposals and stuff to know my way around that game. Mm. And yeah, I applied for a couple of jobs until they presumably finally got sick of me and gave me one for 2 days a week.
Mm.
And just kept kind of building from there.
Okay.
Hmm.
And life in Apollo Bay in the last in these 8 years, how would you?
I've loved it. It's mm-hmm. it's a completely different beast, and again, maybe it's about, you know, I like these intricate problems and these detailed systems. Mm. I'm completely fascinated by small town living and community dynamics, mm. and very frequently, almost daily, overwhelmed and humbled by the actions of people
mm.
in community,
mm.
and the tolerance that is required, and the give and take that people just naturally have to learn to do living in close proximity with limited resources.
Mm.
And it seems a very real way of living. Often stressful, often messy, and there are those times when you just, you know, often on the weekend I just don't want to go out of the house because I see so many people during the mm. week, and I just want to pull the sheet over my head and get some space. But yeah, it's a great thing, the community system. And I love seeing it work.
Mm.
Yeah,
yeah. In some ways, it's just a very big extension of family.
Yeah, it is.
It
is. That's right.
Because there are very few secrets. You know, lots of rumours.
Yep. Yeah.
But the evidence is soon clear.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And I remember someone talking to me once saying, "Oh, how, you know, I'm so amazed that you can live with your father because you're so different." Mm. To which I think this person was probably referring to sort of political sure. kind of differences.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, but you know what? That's actually a really superficial difference. Mm. Who you vote for or the kinds of things you want to see going on around you. They're really superficial, but the similarities are your deep values, your core mm. values. I think that extended family living teaches tolerance.
Mm.
I mean, we're really diverse politically, religiously, economically. Mm. The units in our household, my grandparents, my parents, Pete and I and the kids, we're really diverse,
mm.
but we're all completely similar.
Hmm.
At core as well. And I think that kind of on-ground tolerance is something that is learnt and hmm. is often lacking. And I'm, you know, certainly often completely fail at it. But,
sure.
you know, as we all do when things just get too much. But I really like seeing that tolerance in community of difference.
Well, you have a better chance of developing it in a small place.
I think you have to, yeah.
Because it's right. If you don't develop it,
yeah.
then it becomes the only place and you leave.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Exactly, what yeah.
What about then, so relationship is clearly really important to you.
Yeah.
And place
yeah.
is very important
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, yeah,
where does all that, I mean, you're mm. clearly in this fortunate spot where the people you have relationships mm. with, your relationships are in a place
mm.
that you have affection for and that
yeah.
you have some that informs a
yeah.
bit of who you are.
Yeah.
What do you care to kick around the idea of the influence of place over relationship or whether or not if you had to choose, if you had to say, okay, my relationships are going to live on Mars,
mm.
will I go and have those or will I stay here?
I think the relationship would win
mm.
every time. I think relationship is a particular beast.
Mm.
I think for me at least, and this probably isn't necessarily true of everyone, love of place can be learnt. I mean, I spend a lot of my time, it's probably a really daggy thing to say, but just the normal beauty in things, you mm. know, just opening the front door and looking at the sky and going, oh, my God, look at that.
Yeah.
Or that one drop on the leaf or mm. the way the light's falling. Those are the things that give me maximum pleasure
mm.
throughout my day. And you can find those things
mm.
anywhere.
Mm.
I do love... Having lived here for many years, I love the fact that I've never seen the sea look the same
yeah,
ever.
Yeah. It's amazing.
You know.
Yeah.
And I just learn, particularly through land care, the more I learn about the forest,
mm.
the more I realise how little I know and how incredible that system is. And it kind of blows me away, and I get sort of caught between this excitement of thinking maybe I'll know something more about it one day, and a kind of despair at the amount of wisdom that's necessary to accumulate. But it would be relationship. I would follow my people rather than stick to my place.
Okay.
Yeah.
But all things being equal, they'll bury you on the hill?
Yeah, bury me or something. Yeah,
or
yeah.
Whatever.
All things being equal, definitely. Yeah.
You're here for the duration.
Yeah, that's right. I've never been ambitious in a moving forward kind of sense. I really just want to sit somewhere where I can stare out the window at something lovely and have a cup of coffee in the morning. You know, that's pretty much it.
Well, don't set yourself short and make a contribution.
Make a contribution, yeah. I have... My brain is a terrible hamster in a wheel that just goes around in circles and generates this sort of awful nuclear energy that tends to keep me awake at night. And if I don't feed it, I turn into the sort of person you don't want to be around. And then if I overfeed it, I also turn into that person. So, you know, it's a fine balancing act. But, I need things to do. I need projects to work on in order to keep myself sane. Okay. Yeah, and I like to make them work because the problem of making them work is intriguing. It's all very well to just have an idea, but I have lots of those, and 99% of them just never go anyway. They're just complete fail to launch. But the 1% that get over the line, you know, that's a really gratifying experience. Yeah, yeah.
Libby, it's been delightful talking to you.
Thank you.
I could extend this conversation very easily, but I won't.
Good.
Because you deserve a break.
Thank you.
And we might get you back to talk to you about some other things on another day.
Sure. Lovely.
That has been Libby Riches. Her story so far, and she's only a baby at 41. And this is a program called What's Your Story on 3ABR.